Thank you very much. It's certainly a pleasure to be here and an honor, because I know of the high standard and caliber of the speakers you have. And having gone through the Korean War exhibit, I also know the high caliber of your exhibits. And I would like to thank the various members of the staff who treated me so well here and have done such a good job making a contribution to air power history. And I especially want to thank Brett Stoll over at the archives, who's been a great help to me, not only this week, but in past endeavors. Well, the Korean War came as a great shock to the American public, and it is truly a forgotten war, wedged between World War II and the Vietnam War. It was the first jet-to-jet aerial war. It was the largest jet-to-jet aerial war in terms of claims and of losses. But the battle for air superiority was the one bright spot in that conflict. And, of course, the star of that conflict was the F-86. In my view, one of the prettiest airplanes that ever flew, an elegant aircraft, high-performing, and it proved itself in combat. The pilots of that airplane were celebrated and made heroes, as were the pilots in World War I and World War II. And if I can just take a moment for a little personal note here, I was an aviation enthusiast as a kid, making models, joining the Civil Air Patrol and the rest, and I knew of the F-86, but I didn't get my first glimpse of it until the summer of 1956, when I was standing on the ramp at Lowry Field, and an officer leaned over and a stern voice said, "Gaze, gentlemen, gaze." And it was an F-86 landing, a most impressive sight. A number of those officers had served in Korea, and a few of them had actually registered some claims, which was very heady stuff for a 17-year-old. And you might understand why I, as well as most of my classmates, wanted to be fighter pilots. So that's kind of the background to my connection with the F-86. I never got to fly. I never became a fighter pilot. But I still have this feeling of nostalgia. Tonight, I want to move the discussion beyond what I think is the normal view of the war, which centers just on the aircraft and the machines. And I hope to move it up a notch or so to talk about some of the myths, some of the claims, some of the mysteries that are involved in this this endeavor. I want to discuss some of the recent scholarship, and I hope that we eventually can get around to answering many of the questions. Well, the first thing I want to do is to try to put this into context, because I don't want you to get the idea that the only thing that happened in Korea had to do with the F-86. There was a lot more going on. And we can see this numerically in that the F-86 action, the air superiority action, was only a small part of the air war. In terms of sorties, the air superiority sorties were only three-quarters the number of close air support sorties. And the air superiority sorties were only one-third of the sorties that the Air Force flew in interdiction. So it was a very small part of the war, but a very important part of the war. And in terms of flying hours, the F-86 only flew three-fifths of the flying hours, as did its two rivals, the F-80 and the F-84. In losses, the F-86 units only lost one-third as many casualties as did the F-80 units, and only one-half as many as the F-84 units. So you can get some idea, I hope, the context of this story. Well, the F-86 started off, see if this thing will work for me. There we go. As a straight-wing fighter, and as you can see, looking very much like an F-84, and probably had it gone into service this way, would have performed about that same way. North American realized this, and building on information that came out during the war through wind tunnel tests, and particularly with the experience that they gained from the ME-262, which saw combat in World War II, they innovated by sweeping back the wing. The other influence of the ME-262 on the F-86 had to do with using wing flats, which is, as you many of you know, is an extension of the leading edge, which at low air speeds extends forward, which lowered the speeds that were required for takeoff, landing, and approaches, which made it a much safer aircraft. So clearly there was a German influence with the F-86. The F-86 first flew. I'm going in the wrong direction here. Well, someone's going to have to give me a hand. Oh, here we go. Sorry, I hit the wrong button. This is the model that first flew. This is the experimental F-86, which first flew in October of 1947. You can see its pitot tube and the fact that it did not have any armament. It was flown by the man on the left, test pilot, North American test pilot George Wheaties Welch. And this photograph, he's in the photograph with Gabby Gabreski. They both flew on the 7th of December, 1941. They both got up. Gabreski didn't get any claims that day, but Wheaties Welch claimed 4, was nominated for the Medal of Honor, which he did not get. And Welch goes on to claim a total of 16 Japanese aircraft on 348 combat missions. I should also mention at this time, there are indications that Welch also got the F-86 through the sound barrier a few weeks prior to the better documented and the more famous flight by Chuck Yeager. He did this in a dive because the F-86 could go supersonic in a dive. There were three variants of the F-86 that flew in Korea. The A model, which was superseded by the E model in mid-1951. The E model looked the same as the A model, weighed about 480 pounds more, which decreased performance, but it had an all-flying tail. That is that when the elevator was depressed, the entire horizontal tail moved, which gave the aircraft a lot more maneuverability than the previous model. So although there were some trade-offs involved, it was a better handling aircraft. The third variant was the F-86F, which comes into service in mid-1952, and it was the new improved version. It had a more powerful engine. It also had a redesigned wing, and the wing was the so-called 6-3 wing, which was 6 inches longer at the cord, and it was 3 inches longer to tip, so it was slightly larger. It deleted the wing slats, and as you can see in the corner here, it had a small wing fence. This improved its performance. However, it also increased the stall speed by about 20 knots, but as one pilot correctly noted, you don't win dogfights in the traffic pattern. And this was the ultimate F-86 that saw action in Korea. The F-86 was well known as an honest aircraft, a fine flying aircraft, but there were flying safety issues, particularly when the Air Force was transitioning into jets at this point. The F-86 had a particularly weak nose gear, which caused problems. But I would point out to you that as this graphic, I hope, makes clear, the F-86 had the best flying safety record of those jets. As you can see on the right, whatever metric you use of major accidents or fatal accidents or wrecked aircraft, it was a much safer aircraft than either the F-84 or the F-80, its two rivals at that time. And it had approximately the same flying safety record as the F-51, which was the standard Air Force fighter of the day. The There were a number of efforts made to improve the performance of the F-86. There was an effort to reduce its weight. There was an effort to tweak the engine by adding alcohol water injection. There was an effort to add a liquid rocket engines. There was also an effort made to put air-to-air refueling. They tried both the probe and drogue system, and I know that occurred during the Korean War, and at some point, because this photograph is undated, they also tried the flying boom system. None of these systems were put into effect in the F-86 during the Korean War, although air-to-air refueling was used by other aircraft. Another effort that was made was with solid rocket propellants. In the summer of 1952, they attached 3 1,000-pound rocket boosters to the F-86, and if these were fired simultaneously, they could boost airspeed by 20 knots for 16 seconds. They flew these on over 300 missions, on which about 6 MiGs were knocked down, 2 of which were attributed to having this extra power. But for a variety of reasons, it was not put into service. The second effort that was made that was combat tested was to upgun the F-86. The F-86's initial armament was with 6 50 caliber machine guns, which was the standard armament from World War II. And I think here the Air Force has to take some hits for not improving the armament, because from the very start in Korea, pilots complained that they didn't have enough firepower. So the effort that was made was to upgrade it with 20-millimeter cannons and Project Gun Valve, in which they put 4 20-millimeter cannons of German design on the aircraft. And in early 1953, these were combat tested over Korea. On 284 missions, they knocked down 6 MiGs, but the 20 millimeters proved to be less reliable than the 50s, and the 20 millimeters had an additional problem, which was from the gun gases. The 20 millimeters generated about 4 times as much gun gases as the 50 calibers, and there were 20 instances of engines stalling out. One aircraft was lost because of this. And it turns out, again, the Air Force had messed up. They had tested Project Gun Valve over the states, but only up to 25,000 feet, whereas the aerial combat in Korea initially took place at much higher altitudes, where stalls were much more likely to occur. So the 20 millimeters were not put into service in Korea, although they later were to arm the F-86H and, of course, in other Air Force aircraft as well. Another technology that should be mentioned that is important was the installation of a radar ranging gun sight into the F-86. These were hastily shipped over to the theater and put into service, and the haste turned out to be detrimental in that the gun sights proved to be unreliable. Unreliable because of a lack of parts, unreliable because the pilots weren't properly trained in its use, the maintenance people weren't properly trained, so there were a whole bunch of problems with this device, although when it worked, it really helped a lot. And then we had an interesting incident when senior or older pilots who were aces were asked about this gun sight and what they should do about it. They wanted to get rid of it. They thought it was just 200 pounds of extra weight and really wasn't necessary. And Gabreski, the top American ace in Germany in World War II, supposedly said, "I can put a wad of chewing gum on the windscreen and do just as well." And he probably could. But the younger pilots, the younger aces, they were all for this, and they made the point that for the average pilot, that this gun sight would make them better marksmen and without having all the experience. So this caused some real problems, but the Air Force did hold on to the gun sight, and it proved out in the long run. The other innovation that was used, which was a great advantage for American pilots in Korea, was the G-suit. The G-suit, which inflates when the pilot pulls harsh maneuvers to prevent blackout, was pneumatically inflated around the waist, around the thighs, and around the calves, and it increased the pilot's resistance to Gs between 1 and 2 Gs. What's significant here is that the F-86s had these radar ranging gun sights, and our pilots had G-suits. The pilots we faced had neither, which gave us a significant advantage. An advantage which can be seen by the fact that the one thing that the Russians wanted most was to get our gun sight and to get our G-suits, which I find very interesting. Well, on the other side of the hill, the Soviets were building jets as well, but they get into the game late. They don't fly their first jet until April 1946. But then all of a sudden they receive a bonanza from our ally, the British, who in September of 1946 sell the Soviets their top-of-the-line, state-of-the-art jet engine, which is going to go on to power the MiG-15. And the MiG-15 first flies in December 1947, only a few months after the first flight of the F-86. And these two aircraft, in a number of ways, are similar, both having a swept wing of 35 degrees and both having a nose inlet. But this photo doesn't really show it clearly. The F-86 has a low-mounted wing, the MiG-15 a mid-mounted wing. The MiG has the wing fences, and also it has the horizontal stabilizer halfway up, the vertical stabilizer. The MiG-15 was redlined at 0.292 Mach, so it could not go as fast as the F-86. And when it approached its red line, the controls became stiffer and stiffer, and it was a much less stable aircraft. Whereas I've already mentioned, the F-86 could exceed the speed of sound in a dive. The MiG also had handling problems. It apparently was a tricky aircraft to fly. It stalled easily and then went into vicious spins. In 52 and 53, American pilots reported seeing 56 MiGs fall into spins, and they reported of those 56 incidents that 35 of the pilots either bailed out or were seen to crash. So this was an airplane that was tricky. But it was, in the Soviet style, it was simple, it was rugged, it was effective, and for the task for which it was designed as an interceptor. It was designed to knock down heavy bombers. It was designed to knock down B-29s, and in Korea, it did just that. It was armed, and it had an armament problem as well. It was armed with 137mm and 223mm cannons. So it's kind of curious that both aircraft had armaments which were less than fully effective. But nevertheless, the MiG-15 surprised the West because it turned out in a number of areas to have superior performance to our best aircraft, the F-86. Well, I won't recap the entire Korea War for you. And again, I want to compliment the curators here for the excellent exhibit. I went through the exhibit this morning, and I'm trying very hard not to be redundant because they've stolen most of my thunder here and done it very effectively. Anyway, we quickly gained air superiority after our ground troops got thrown back. The North Koreans had about 120 World War II aircraft, and once we got into the fray, we quickly wiped them out, and by the end of July had complete air superiority. The war turns around when UN forces land in Incheon on the 15th of September, 1950, and MacArthur says the war is going to be over by Thanksgiving, and the troops will be home for Christmas. And, of course, that didn't proved to be the case when the Chinese intervened massively in November of 1950 with ground troops covered by the MiG-15. And most of the fighting that we're talking about took place in this area, the striped area, which is known as MiG Alley. The first MiGs were seen on the 1st of November, 1950. They were very quickly seen to be superior to the aircraft we had in the theater, both the prop-powered fighters as well as the straight-wing jets. And I guess I need to note here very quickly, we now know that these aircraft were piloted by Soviet pilots from regular Soviet units. The myth at the time that was propagated at the time for diplomatic reasons, and I think lingers in the mind of many people, that it was mainly Chinese pilots with a few Russian instructors. We knew as early as March of 51 from the radio intercepts that these were Soviet. So initially we were going head-to-head with Soviet pilots, many of whom were veterans of World War II and well experienced. On the 8th of November of 1950, the first MiG-15 is shot down by a F-80 pilot. And on that same day, the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, Hoyt Vandenberg, orders an F-86 unit to go over to Korea to make sure that we have the balance of power. And they send over the 4th Fighter Group, which was the lineal descendant of the famous Eagle squadrons from World War II, and the unit which in World War II is given credit for destroying the most German aircraft in the air and on the ground. So they go into action on the 15th of December. And then on the 17th of December, the figure in the middle, Lieutenant Colonel Bruce Hinton, shoots down the MiG, the first MiG to fall to an F-86, the first of many. From the outset, we are terribly surprised to find the MiG has performance advantage over the F-86. Because the two airplanes are powered by engines of similar thrust, and the MiG is lighter than the F-86, it has the advantage of greater acceleration, superior rate of climb, and particularly superior ceiling. The F-86 has the advantage it can outdive the MiG. It has better speed brakes. It has better visibility with its canopy and particularly its defrosting system, which you might think that's kind of a simple, why would you mention that? But when you're going from 40,000 feet down to the deck in very brief time in humid conditions, and your canopy frosts up, you're in deep trouble. Our defrosters work. The MiG-15s did not work very well at all. So there were a number of advantages that the Sabre had, particularly that it could transition from one maneuver to another quicker. It had better controls. On the 20th of May, 1951, James Jabara becomes the first American jet ace when he shoots down two airplanes, two MiGs, despite the fact that he had a hung-up wing tank, which by policy he should have aborted the mission, but does not, and he gets the accolade of being the first American jet ace. Well, the battle for air superiority increases as the communists pump in more aircraft. The Soviets are joined by both Chinese and North Korean pilots towards the end of 1951. And to right that balance, we send over the F-86E, which I've mentioned, the upgrade to the original F-86, in mid-1951. And then in December of 1951, a second F-86 unit is formed. And this is the 51st Fighter Group, which is distinguished by the checkerboard tail. It had been an F-80 outfit, and they were transitioned into F-86s. So we upped the ante, and now we have two F-86 fighter groups that are involved. Well, the increase of numbers and the introduction of the F-86E leads to the fact that we are able to knock down a greater number of MiG-15s. And this graphic, I hope, makes this clear. In 1951, we knocked down an average of 18 MiGs a month. In 1952, we knocked down an average of 31 MiGs a month. And in the 7 months of 1953, we knocked down 41 MiGs a month, with the top month being June of 1953, right before the war was over, when we claimed 78. So these were two factors, more F-86s, F-86E. Other factors were the fact that the Russians were rotating out their more experienced units, and the new pilots that were coming in were less experienced. The Chinese, the North Korean pilots were less experienced. So these all played a factor. But I would emphasize another factor which is not well known by most people, and that is the intrusions of American pilots into China. Now, the conventional wisdom holds that there were some intrusions, but these were done by either rogue fighter pilots or MiG-crazy fighter pilots or some poor guy who was, you know, lost in the weather and mistakenly crossed the river. But, you know, it was infrequent, and it was only done by accident. That's not the case. Our intrusions into China were frequent, and they were well known by the high command up through Tokyo. Now, one of the F-86 group commanders recounts the story that he was called in and chewed out because there were reports that the F-86 had gone into China. And after General Everest left the room, he sighed a sign of relief. And then Everest apparently pokes his head back in and points his finger at this poor colonel and says, "And damn it, if you're going to fly into China, turn off your damn IFF. The IFF, of course, is the Identification Friend and Foe, the radar device which allowed, if it was turned on, allowed ground stations to know where American pilots were. So Everest knew about these intrusions. Field grade officers, wing commanders, group commanders, squadron commanders not only condoned this, but they led missions into Korea, into China. So there were a lot of action over China. My research indicates that probably half of our aces, half of the 40 F-86 aces, claimed at least one MiG over China. And of the 11 top aces, these are the ones who got 10 or more victories, 9 of the 11 got at least one victory. So I think, you know, and of course this stuff is not documented, you know, so we don't have any documents, but I interviewed about 60 F-86 pilots, as well as if you read their memoirs, and you'll see this. Some of these pilots believed that they had the right of hot pursuit. And although that was approved all the way up the chain of command, it was never approved from Washington. They never had the right of hot pursuit. So there were a lot of intrusions. From what I've been able to find out, possibly only 3 pilots were punished for flying into China. Documentation is sketchy, but apparently Joseph McConnell, who I'll mention a little bit later, apparently was grounded for 2 weeks. Another ace, a double ace, Lonnie Moore, was sent home very rapidly for having gone into over China. And again, this is sketchy. The third instance, Dolph Overton, we know more about because I interviewed Overton, so face to face. Overton had flown one tour in F-84s and then got into F-86s. He goes to a radar station and sits down with the radar set and figures out where the communist landing pattern is. And what he does, he goes up and he starts to orbit the Chinese landing pattern and is therefore able to shoot down 5 MiGs in 4 days. He becomes the quickest ace. But unfortunately for Overton, his timing was bad. And as you know, in life, timing is probably everything. Turns out that on one of these days, a squadron commander had been shot down 100 miles inside of China. So that got people's attention. And the other fact was that on one of these missions, a UN fact-finding team was traveling across China, and they look up, and there's a dogfight going on in China. So they send rockets, and of course, you know, it all goes downhill. And a staff officer from Tokyo comes over and interviews the pilots that flew that day. And when Overton was asked, did you fly into China, he admits that he did. They shipped him home immediately. They stripped him of his medals, which he did not get until about a decade ago. And they even tried to get rid of his kill credits as well. But that's the only instances that I know of pilots being punished. Okay, another part of the story which you know part of because the museum is part of was the exploitation of this equipment by both sides. In April of 1951, we found out that a MiG had crashed land deep inside of North Korea, about 35 miles inland and north of Pyongyang. We sent in a team that had been specially trained, and they go about ripping apart the engine and parts of the engine. They get the whole empennage into this helicopter before they come under ground fire until they scoot out of there. And then a couple of months later, in June of 1951, another MiG is seen to go down in the mud flats off of North Korea. So we send in a small group of naval vessels, Royal Navy, U.S., and ROK. And these poor photographs are of them salvaging parts of this. And they're able to get out essentially the engine. So we were able to get some pieces of the MiG-15. But it's not until March of 1953 that a Polish defector brings a MiG into Denmark. Our intelligence people get a hold of this, take photographs, they disassemble it, and then reassemble it before they give it back to the Poles. So that was the first one we got to see, you know, up close and personal. Perhaps as a result of this, the next month in April 1953, a project is started in the theater called Project Mula, where we offer $100,000 to a communist pilot to bring in a MiG, and we drop a couple million leaflets, you know, all over the place. And lo and behold, in September of 1953, a MiG-15 lands at Seoul. And I might quickly add that the pilot indicates that he never heard of Project Mula. That was a complete surprise to him. And that MiG was quickly taken down to Okinawa and flight tested. You can see here with the F-86 chase plane by five American pilots, including Major General Albert Boyd. And you'll note here, and I want to bring this out to you, that it was repainted in American markings, you know, at this point. And I don't know how long it stayed in American markings. But as you know, this is the airplane that's currently on display not too far from here, back in its North Korean markings. And what we found out was that the intelligence we had was pretty well confirmed about the MiG's advantages and disadvantages. The only great story that I won't go into detail, but Chuck Yeager tried to get the MiG to go supersonic because there were rumors it could go supersonic. Took it up the highest altitude he could go at, full power, and he doesn't go straight down. He goes down at an angle because the nose tucked under, and tried to get it to supersonic, and it wouldn't go supersonic. And I guess he was lucky to survive. The communists tried to get F-86s. As I mentioned, they wanted the gun sight, they wanted the G-suit, but they wanted an F-86. They organized a unit in April of 51 of test pilots trying to capture a MiG, an F-86, and they failed miserably at that. But then a few months later, in October of 51, an F-86 gets shot up. The pilot can't eject, so he's forced to crash land a MiG on the mudflats, the F-86 on the mudflats. The pilot is rescued, but the communists get the entire aircraft, and they're able to take it back. Later in May of 52, a second F-86 crash lands, and they get that one as well. According to Soviet records, they never flew the F-86. They certainly took it apart and examined it, but they never flew it. One last point I want to make here. There are rumors that American F-86 pilots were held after the war. This is kind of the Rambo scenario. Bear in mind that at the end of the Korean War, 13,000 Americans were declared missing in action. And I just saw a newspaper clipping a couple months ago which stated that there were still 8,000 MIAs from the Korean War. At the end of the war, 220 Air Force crew members were released from captivity, including 28 F-86 pilots. Nevertheless, there were congressional hearings in 1996 where this issue was explored with all kinds of fragmentary third-party information that pilots were seen, et cetera, but no smoking gun. And I see no evidence, and I am of the belief that that just did not occur. Okay, to change without much of a segue, one of the issues of the war has to do with numbers. And I was always under the impression that the F-86s were terribly outnumbered in the war. Now, they were outnumbered, but it turns out not so terribly. The bar on the left is official numbers, the blue being the F-86 sorties, and the red being the Chinese and Soviet sorties. And this comes out to an advantage to the communists of about 3 F-86 sorties for every 4 MiG-15 sorties. And, of course, you have to add in the North Korean. As far as fightings, that's an approximation. But the most important is the bars on the right of those engaged, and these are Air Force figures. And it comes out that about 3 F-86s engaged about 4 MiG-15. So they were outnumbered, but it's not, you know, astronomically, as you might think. The more controversial or the most controversial numbers, however, have to do with claims and losses. Now, claims have always been a problem in aviation history, and understandably so. In the fast action, obviously pilots have other things to do besides, you know, see what happens to the guy they just shot up. So this has always been a problem. But in the Korean War, it was an especial problem. The bar on the left are U.S. figures. The F-86s claimed 800 MiG-15s. In addition to those 800, there were another 36 MiGs claimed by other Air Force aircraft, and then Marines and Navy pilots and Marine and Navy aircraft claimed 9. But I just want you to look at the F-86s, the 800 claimed by them. The U.S. Air Force admits to having lost about 210 F-86s, but only about half of those to enemy action. And if you look at those numbers and put them together, I think it's fairly certain that we lost approximately 100 F-86s in air-to-air combat, or a claim to loss ratio of about 8-1. No big deal. The problem is when we look at the Chinese and the Soviet figures, because the Chinese and the Soviets, they claim to have knocked down 860 F-86s. And then, of course, you have to add on the North Korean. They do admit to having lost about 540. My point is that there's such a discrepancy between the claims that the Soviets make and the Chinese make and the aircraft we lost, not only to completely frustrate the researcher, but to throw their numbers into discredit. So unless you believe there was a conspiracy by the U.S. Air Force to conceal F-86 losses, and I see absolutely no evidence of this, and I've looked, you know, through the records, I don't believe in conspiracies, whether it's Pearl Harbor or Roswell or 9/11. You can't reconcile this difference. Okay, then. So you have the issue of numbers. Then we finally get to the aces. And there's an excellent painting downstairs that you have in display, which is from this photograph, which is 5 of the top aces of the 4th Fighter Group. And from left to right is Lonnie Moore, Vermont Garrison, James Johnson, and they're actually standing in front of his F-86, although you'll see only 9 credits on his airplane. Next is Ralph Parr, Parr got the last victory in the war, a very controversial kill that took place. And then finally on the right is James Jabara. The four of them got 10 claims. Jabara got 15. So these are five of your top aces of the war. But a more formal photograph is this one, obviously taken in Washington, appropriately under the view of Hap Arnold, with, my pointer doesn't work, but the Vice Chief of Staff, Nate Twining, Secretary of the Air Force, Harold Talbot, Chief of Staff, Nate Twining, Boots Blase, who had 10 victories, John Meyer, who had 24 victories in German aircraft. He got two in Korea. And then in the front row, you can see Gabreski on the left. He had 28 over Germany and then 6.5 in Korea. And to his right is Ivan Kinchlow, who had five kills. So these are your top aces. But the top ace of the war was Joseph McConnell. McConnell was 31 years of age when he got his fifth kill and had about 1,100 flying hours. Ironically, McConnell had washed out of pilot training during World War II and flew as a navigator in B-24s in World War II. But then after the war, he goes on to earn his wings and then goes to Korea. After becoming an ace, he was shot down and fished out of the Yellow Sea by Air Sea Rescue. On his last day in combat, he flies two missions, and on those two missions, he knocks down three MiGs to run his total up to 16 to become the top ace in the war. He got 16 MiGs on 106 missions. He was to be killed in a flying accident, test flying an F-86H in August of 1954. The second in rank order was James Jabara on the left. Jabara was 27.5 when he got his fifth MiG and had about 1,800 flying hours. He had flown two tours in World War II, two tours, 168 combat missions, where he was credited with 1.5 German aircraft. He flies two tours in Korea, where he runs his total up to 15 on 163 missions. And he was on active duty when he was killed in an automobile accident in November of 1966. He's shaking hands here with Pete Fernandez. This is when Fernandez actually got his fifth kill. He's congratulating him on that. Fernandez was 28 at this point and had about 2,100 flying hours. Fernandez had gotten his wings during World War II but did not see any combat, but then became a gunnery instructor and had the reputation of being one of the best shots in the Air Force and apparently had been an instructor to McConnell. Fernandez knocks down 14.5 MiGs on 125 missions. He retires from the Air Force as a major in 1963 and then is killed in a very controversial flying accident in October of 1980. And here are these two of these top aces being congratulated by the president. Well, I'm not going to go through all the other aces, although that would be a lot of fun, but I do want to mention one other, the one non-Air Force F-86 ace of the war, and this was Marine Major John Bolt. Bolt had knocked down six Japanese airplanes in World War II and six MiGs. And this allows me to introduce you to a subject that we haven't talked about and is not in display, and that is a number of exchange pilots who flew F-86s. He was one of at least 51 exchange pilots. I've been able to identify about 51. We had exchange pilots from the Marines, Navy, RAF, RCAF, and these 51 pilots knocked down, I got credit for knocking down 49 airplanes. The most famous of these, probably, though, is someone else near and dear to the heart of those of you from the great Buckeye State. If I can get the slide to move, and that's Marine Major John Glenn. Glenn got three victories in 10 days in the last days of the war, and probably would have been an ace had the war gone on. I should also mention that Glenn admits in his memoirs that he got one of these airplanes over China. So I think we've touched the major points, at least the major points as I see them, of the story of the F-86, the fight for air superiority in ACES. To summarize then, we now know that we initially were fighting against Soviet pilots in regular Soviet units. We now know that intrusions into China were frequent and were condoned and even led by top-ranking Air Force officers. Unfortunately, we don't know any more about the claims issue except that it's very frustrating, and I guess in my view, it's never going to be resolved. It's going to be one of those terrible, terrible mysteries. But this is really not important, I don't think, because regardless of the numbers, what's significant is that the F-86s won air superiority, and they won it with two exceptions, and I should make this clear so I don't get dinged in the Q&A about this. The two exceptions of the air superiority was the so-called Bed Check Charlie, and these were communist pilots who flew obsolete World War II biplane trainers at night that we were never able to effectively stop, which harassed our troops. And the other was in MiG Alley, the MiGs were able to drive the B-29s out of the daytime skies and force the B-29s to bomb at night. And those are the two major exceptions. Otherwise, we had air superiority. And this air superiority was won not with superior numbers. It was won not with a superior aircraft, because the MiG did have its advantage. And it was won not in the way it was won in World War II. When in World War II, we bombed out enemy fighter factories, we attacked enemy aircraft on the ground, which, by the way, was the one thing that was not done in Korea. We went into China, but we never shot up communist aircraft on the ground. But it was done an air-to-air. And it was done, of course, because of superior pilots. Pilots were more experienced, pilots who were better trained, pilots who were more aggressive than the pilots that they faced. And air superiority was significant in that it allowed American, allied, UN missions to be flown in close superiority, close air support, and in interdiction. There were few allied losses to enemy air. In fact, I'm pretty certain that we lost more allied ground troops to friendly fire than we did from communist aircraft, where conversely, we caused considerable casualties to the communist and made his life very difficult with air-to-air, and I think really were a deciding factor in how that war turned out. So air power was significant in the outcome of the war, and I think a proud episode in aviation history. The last thing I'd like to do before I conclude is to flash up a little bibliography, and maybe this is my teaching experience, to leave something for those of you who are interested in a macro view of the war, particularly their superiority. I would recommend a number of these books. So thank you very much. I look forward to the Q&A.